thousand times, and more times than I can count, I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
life from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City, and I welcome you. We're also simulcasting over our sister station, WBAI in New York, for 38 years nearly, and our sister station in Washington, D.C., WPFW, for nearly 31 years, plus stations all over the United States. Today, we'll be having the first exclusive, in-depth look at a major scandal. And this is based upon the Trans-Pacific Partnership we have now through WikiLeaks and through Public Citizen. We have gotten a copy of one of the chapters. We will show you how corrupt it is, why this president, specifically and personally, working with a cabal of industry supporters, have crafted this and now putting it on the fast track that would undermine our health and well-being. I'm quite sure that WikiLeaks has the entire document. I'm also sure that this will be released over a period of time and not all at once. But at least you'll see the truth of what we've been saying. You've heard me say on at least 100 separate programs that this is the most dangerous treaty in the history of the United States. This treaty, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, would virtually guarantee that our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, our state laws, our federal laws, our community laws would all be put in second place in their significance based upon the sovereignty of the legal foundation of this treaty. So you could not protest. And if you chose to protest, you would have to protest through a group of arbiters that are lawyers working on behest of the major corporations involved in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, all done in secret, and their findings would be final. You would not be able to go to a court of appeals or U.S. Supreme Court. You would have no rights whatsoever. What does it say about the mindset of legislators, public officials, government, and private partnerships working in secret to undermine the very sovereignty of our lives? But they're doing it. We will have the first exclusive interview of any radio program in the United States in a few moments. Later on in our program, we're going to show you another major scandal, one that the entire American media and virtually the entire left has missed. And that is the scandal of the Federal Reserve, one of the most corrupt and vile organizations. It is not a governmental agency. It is a private consortium. And we're going to talk specifically about how they have been responsible for manipulating, with partners in their private banks, the price of gold. You will have one of the world's leading authorities on this subject, Kelly Mitchell. And we're going to talk about, for example, on just one single short of $1.2 billion worth of gold on April 30th, that's 750 ounces, what that did to the price of gold. Who is wanting to keep the price of gold down? Where would it be if it were not artificially manipulated? The role of gold in the battle of nations and in the global economy of the world. Why are we afraid of having the price of gold rise and silver rise? What would it do to the value of the dollar? What is happening to the dollar? What happens when it's no longer the reserve currency? What will that mean for us? Also today, time permitting, a commentary by Ralph Nader on opting out of the corporate state of surveillance, a commentary from Ellen Brown on Web of Debt. Professor Brown will be having a new program on our station starting, I believe, next week, the bank guarantee that bankrupted Ireland. Now, why is this important? Why should you know this? Because the very institutions, the major bondholders, the hedge funds, the equity partnerships, the major bankers, these are the ultimate one percenters. These are the people that make all the other people who are in the 1% seem poor by comparison. These people make sure that whenever there's a failure, they profit. We pay. Now, whether it's in Iceland, whether it's in Spain, or Portugal, or Italy, or France, or Crete, they get their money out. What happened in Ireland then becomes a blueprint for what is happening in every other country, who's behind it, how it happened, and how all the people of Ireland were victimized. But the bankers and those they control in Parliament, and this wouldn't happen if they didn't control, you think are sociopaths that are we elect, and that tells us more about we, the people, than it does the legislators. We know what kind of mindsets they have. We know how culpable they are. We know what lacking moral fiber they have. We know how stupid they are in basic concepts and how they refuse to define themselves and stand strong on behalf of the public. We know that. But what does it say about when we continually put these people back in power, knowing full well how they've abused that power? This will be discussed. Also today, the latest environmental report shows, quote, the world energy outlook does not look good for planet Earth. And who is saying this? This is the conclusion reached yesterday by the World Economic Outlook and over 2,000 scientists. What do they say? Now, you've been hearing on this program and others that we cannot survive as we know it. We'd have to make massive modifications, but in all likelihood, most species of animals, plants, and many humans would not survive this. If we go above 2%, 2 degrees centigrade rise in the global target, they're saying we're going to go to 3.6%, fueled by industrial emissions that will grow by a troubling 20% in just the next decade or so. What does this mean? It means that we are beyond chaos when it comes to our environment. Also from our public health segment, if time permits, 9 Things Everyone Should Know About Farmed Fish by David Simon. I'm willing to bet that virtually 95% of all the fish that people are eating are coming from factory farms. Have you ever visited them? I have. They are a mess. Why wouldn't you want to eat fish that is factory farmed? Well, I'll explain how everything you've been told is wrong. But let us begin with our lead story today, and then we'll go to health and nutrition after this. Here is the bottom line. We have been kept in the secret at all levels. The media, the governmental agencies, legislators, journalists, we have not been told what is in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What we have found out from leaks is that more than 600 lobbyists working on behest of major international globalized corporations have been writing this up. Well, if it's in our best interest, why shouldn't we be aware of what's being written? Nothing has come out, and yet the President of the United States now wants to fast-track it, get it through as quickly as possible by the end of the year. WikiLeaks has obtained, I believe, the entire, I bet anything they have the entire document, but they only released one chapter. Public Citizen received it. Quote, WikiLeaks and analyzed by Public Citizen revealed that the Obama administration is demanding terms that would limit internet freedom and access to life-saving medicines throughout the Asian Pacific region and bind Americans to the same bad rules, belying the administration's stated commitments to reduce health care costs and advance free expression online. WikiLeaks published the complete draft of the intellectual property chapter. That's just one chapter, and it's startling. The leak shows the United States seeking to impose the most extreme demands of Big Pharma, speaking on behalf of Big Pharma, and Hollywood. And despite the express and frequent universal opposition of U.S. trade partners, concerns raised by the Trans-Pacific Partnership, negotiating partners, and many civic groups worldwide regarding Trans-Pacific Partnership undermining access to affordable medicines, the internet, and even textbooks have resulted in a deadlock over the Trans-Pacific Partnership's intellectual property chapter, leading to an impasse in the talks. Quote, the Obama administration's proposal are the worst. Let me repeat this. Quote, the Obama administration's proposals are the worst, the most damaging for health we have seen in a U.S. trade agreement to date, meaning ever. The Obama administration, quote, has backtracked from even the modest health considerations adopted under the Bush administration. And that was according to Peter from Public Citizen. And, quote, the Obama administration's shameful bullying on behalf of giant drug companies would lead to preventable suffering and death. And soon the administration is expected to propose additional terms that would lock Americans into high prices for cancer drugs for years to come. Let us now go to my guest, who is standing by to explore this in greater depth. She is Dr. Margaret Flowers. She is a board-certified physician, currently working full-time on the reform of America's health care in favor of a single-payer or Medicare for All system. She is co-chair of the Maryland chapter of the Physicians for National Health Program and one of its advisors. And she is also one of the organizers of an 18,000-strong physician member support of single-payer universal health coverage. And she is a graduate of University of Maryland and also did a residency at Johns Hopkins University Hospital. The website is clearingfogradio.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for inviting me on, Gary.
Let's go through this from what we now know versus what we suspected, and let's put this in proper perspective. We have the most costly medical-industrial complex in the world, $3.3 trillion this year. We also rank near the bottom of industrialized worlds in longevity, infant mortality. We are at the top of the list, not a good place to be, number one in obesity in children, diabetes, adult diabetes in children, people being given medications for so-called mental illnesses. 10 million American children under the age of 18 are now on some form of psychotropic drug. We have more heart disease and cancer and stroke per population in any other country in the world, and yet we continue to believe that this administration and the previous administration and the administration before that believe that we have the best and brightest in doctors, medicine, hospitals, and we should just trust them. This then becomes an extension of that, that once this is implemented, your physician, your health care provider would not be able to provide you with the health care that they deem best in your interest and you deem best once we are signatories to this because of a pharmaceutical company and other organizations have written the laws. How then in the world does this help make us a healthier country? Your thoughts, please.
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership absolutely takes us in the wrong direction on so many levels. I've written about how it will undermine our health system and other health systems around the world by preventing us from being able to go to the real solution we need, a publicly financed public health system like a Medicare for All. It will undermine our public health programs that we have right now because it will, you know, the private corporations will have to be allowed legally to compete with our public programs. It will take away any sorts of advantages that our public health programs have that private programs see as unfair advantages. It will protect the patents of pharmaceutical products, medical devices, and now even procedures, surgical procedures will be patented. So how is that going to play out? Does that mean that, we're going to have to pay to use those surgical procedures? It's just mind-boggling where this is going. So that's, some of the impacts that this is going to have on healthcare. It gives these corporations even greater legal rights than they currently have to challenge reimbursement for their products. So they really are going to have control of the price, and their bottom line is to maximize what they can get. So that runs counter to what we need in terms of having a health system that works for everyone. But I think what's also concerning is that, healthcare or our health has so much more to do than just access to health care, but, do we have access to healthy food, to clean water, to a clean environment, clean air? And the Trans-Pacific Partnership really just gives these large corporations license to pollute and to hide what they are using in their products, what is in our food, what they're putting into the environment. And so that is very concerning to me.
I was also told that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would prevent an American citizen or any citizen that is in a country that is a part of this from knowing the country of origin of what is manufactured or grown. As a result, you wouldn't know where your fish comes from. You wouldn't know where a medicine comes from.
Right, and it lowers the bar on safety standards for our foods rather than raising the bar on them. Because the bottom line of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and we have to realize it's 29 chapters and only 4 or 5 of them have anything to do with typical trade matters. It's really a much more than trade. This is really a corporate power grab. And the bottom line is to remove any sorts of barriers that interfere with profits from these corporations. It's mind-boggling that it actually undermines our laws down to the local level. So if a community decides that they want to pass a law that protects their workers, their environment, or people in their community, these corporations can challenge those laws in a court that operates outside of our judicial system, in which the judges that decide are corporate lawyers on leave from their job to serve as judges, then they go back to their job. So it really takes away our sovereignty at every level, at the local, state, and federal level in this country, and our ability to protect ourselves.
Do you find it ironic that those who support a Democratic or a liberal perspective rarely cite, except for the ACLU and some who are true liberals and true Democrats, as there are true conservatives, they rarely cite the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and our freedoms and our sovereignty. And yet, here we have those very rights being taken away, and our Constitution, for all intents and purposes, if this passes, if the Trans-Pacific Partnership passes, our Constitution won't be worth anything. If it comes in face-to-face in a challenge with the corporate interest of one of the people who drafted these laws.
Yeah, I mean, the Trans-Pacific Partnership really undermines, the sovereignty of all nations. It's the same agenda that the World Trade Organization has been trying to push, for more than a decade and has been successful in doing. And so the Trans-Pacific Partnership and its sister, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TAFTA, are kind of a backdoor to getting that agenda. We call it a global corporate coup, because that really is what it amounts to, is that in addition to we would have to make all of our laws be in compliance with the language in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, then it would give corporations the right to sue us if we make laws that interfere with their profits, and it also gives them the right to challenge our court decisions. And the other thing that's interesting about this international tribunal is that it's like an appellate type of court in which the corporation would be allowed to present its case, but the government would not be allowed to present its case, and we would have no ability to challenge the decision that was made in that court.
That's fascism at its worst, and they've dressed it up. I'm just surprised that the American public has not been outraged. The American media has been complicit, especially the New York Times and the Washington Post. Why should we expect the Washington Post to be anything other than what it is? But I'm concerned that the labor unions have not called for a general strike. What has happened to their leadership? I know the rank and file are honest. I don't trust any of the leadership. I just see them selling out. If you really let me explain this, let me make myself clear, Dr. Flowers. All right, I'm going to take on anyone on this issue. If you say you're for your members, if you say you're for freedom, if you say you're for living wage, and something is going to eviscerate that, then if I don't see you out there in front of the White House with every ounce of power you have, then you're a hypocrite. Don't tell me you're doing something on someone's interest, and then in closed meetings behind doors, you sell out your own membership, and that's been going on for too long in unions in the United States. Sorry I have to talk about that, but that's the reality.
No, it is. It's absolutely the reality, and labor has been undermining itself and weakening, and that's a huge problem because we need a strong labor movement to protect workers. So the AFL-CIO has made some statements saying that they oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There was a resolution in their last national convention. But they're also not willing to come out strongly and say that that they wouldn't actually allow the TPP to go through if there was some language inserted into it protecting workers. This is something that Kevin Zeese and I wrote about a few weeks ago in Truth Out, is that there is the possibility that labor, and it has been done before, would say they're opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership because of the harm it will do to workers, but then work with the Congress to say, or work with the negotiators to say, that if you put in certain language that protects the workers, then we'll say that it's okay. Knowing full well that that's been used before, most recently in the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, they demanded that labor protection was inserted. And what we've seen down there is that the conditions are worse. More organizers are being killed. They've had, you know, huge mass protests down there of the workers because they're really being exploited. So language doesn't do anything, and that's why we really have to push these organizations to take a much stronger stance.
Hold on. Let's back up a moment. Let's focus on what you just said. We have to pay more attention on getting these people, meaning people who have responsibility, not just fiduciary, but more responsibility for the people who have entrusted them, to make the right choices, which means, by the other end of your argument, that if you and others were not a voice of consciousness speaking to them, they would not do the right thing. Then that means that our legislators are not doing the right thing, our media not doing the right thing, our church leaders not doing the right thing, the synagogue leaders not doing the right thing. Who in the hell in America is doing the right thing unless we force them to? Please answer that, Dr. Flowers.
Well, that's the sad situation that we're in right now. And so we have to expose these hypocrisies and expose the truths, and that's why having something like WikiLeaks is just absolutely essential right now. I mean, the media has been complicit. There have been efforts, and I know because we've been behind some of them, to try to get the media to cover the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and yet, for the most part, they've refused to do that. So now that the WikiLeaks has released this text, you know, we're launching a campaign to try to shame them into covering it, because, you know, they're just going to look bad if everybody else is finding out about it, but they're refusing to comment on it. So that's a big reason why people around the country have not been aware of the TPP
because of
this media blackout.
I appreciate that insight. We need a grassroots movement. I do not see any benefit to reforming anything. I have never in my lifetime seen anything reformed to a level where it transcended the previous limitations of what it was supposed to be changing. I believe you change something. If something's not working, you change it. You change it in a way that you go in and you just, like a frame-off restoration, you don't put a rug over a rotted-out, termite-ridden floor. You rip it out, you put in a new floor. And I believe that we have not had the will nor the desire, and we've been engaged in our own interest. We have been suffering from massive hubris, and as a result, in every area of our lives, we have seen this undermining. Look, you're a physician. You're a board-certified physician, and you and about 18,000 other physicians that we know of, at least who have come forward. I'm sure there are many more who have not yet come forward, but believe that we should have universal health care, as any reasonable person would. But what does it say for the other 800,000 physicians who have not or do not believe in it or don't care? Then you have to remind them of what it means to be a patient, when the patient could be suffering from conditions that A, could be prevented, B, could be treated easier, better, safer, and not go based on cookbook medicine. If you did nothing in your whole practice as a pediatrician but use only what you were taught medical school, then I would challenge you as engaging in malpractice. You had to think beyond what conditioning you were given. You didn't know whether or not the chair of your department of pediatrics was paid for by some pharmaceutical industry wanting you to prescribe a particular way of treating a condition. At some point, you had to engage in your own innate sensibility, your own sense of common sense and reasoning, your own inner relationship with that patient to help make that patient outcome better. Would you agree or disagree with that?
But we could have do a whole show on why physicians in this country are in the state that they're in and aren't fighting back more. And that's something that Physicians for National Health Program has been trying to do, is to give physicians that the tools that they need in order to do that. It's just, one physician that I work with says that the doctors in this country are in a state of grieving. They're, you know, some are in denial, some are trying to bargain with the system, some have just given up and accepted it, some are really angry at it. It's we have a healthcare system that's not about health. It's about profit, and it undermines the integrity of physicians. It forces them into a system in which they can't even practice the art. That's why I left practice. But the good news is that more younger physicians and medical students are starting to get involved, and we're really hoping to push that and grow that, because they really need to be empowered to take back control of our healthcare system and demand a system that works for people.
Well, you're certainly an example of what people should be doing, but where you said that the physicians believe that they're in a state of grieving, I think many of them are in a state of greeting. I would use an adjective to describe that state, and also in denial. I believe that we don't take, if you want to grieve for someone, be the rheumatologist that grieve for the 65,000 who died because of the prescription drug Vioxx. Then your grieving is not self-pity. Grieving because somehow you're limited is not the same as grieving for the mistakes that have been made that should never have been made because of the institutionalization, commodification, and commercialization of what should be a sacred art, the art of helping in the healing process of a patient. We have lost that, except for those who still have a moral conscience. And I thank you and the 18,000 physicians who are members of the Physicians for National Health Program. It is a beginning. And also with Trans-Pacific Partnership, all the people listening should raise hell and protest with your legislators and let them know, do not fast track this. This is completely corrupt. Everything in this is one-sided. This would take away the Constitution. This would take away our state rights, our environmental rights, and all the rights that I voted for Ralph Nader and Jill Stein. And I would have voted for others on the independent tickets because they weren't compromisable. They went in with integrity. They would have maintained their integrity. But unfortunately, the vast majority of people saw otherwise. But remember, an empowered minority still has power. And at the end of the day, we as groups, and there are probably 5 or 10 million of us who are looking at what's right instead of what is convenient or easy, we'll fight the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We will let our legislators know. If it takes 1,000 letters, 1,000 phone calls, 1,000 emails to your legislator to remind them, we are not going to stand by and allow the sovereignty of America to be taken over by this 600 group corporation for their economic interest. So for all that good work you're doing, thank you. And final comment from you.
Yes, thank you. I mean, that's an excellent point. And so we do have a campaign that we've had for a while now called Flush the TPP. It's Flush, F-L-U-S-H, the TPP.org. And last night in over a dozen cities, people came out and took action to expose the TPP. Just this week, both the Republicans and Democrats coalition on both sides released letters saying that they oppose fast track. So the momentum is building, and we need to really push it. Towns are starting to pass resolutions saying they won't obey, and we're working towards an international day of action on December 3rd, the first day that the WTO meetings begin. So I encourage people, go to flushthetpp.org, look at the tools, look at the news page, and organize actions in your community, because we are starting to move this, and we can succeed.
Thank you very much, Dr. Margaret Flowers.
Thank you.
And again, we have been all over this story. We will continue to be over it. And as other chapters of the other 29 chapters coming, 28 chapters, we will be here to share insights on it. We do not believe in reforming it. We do not believe in tweaking it. We believe in eliminating it. We believe that it shouldn't exist because it does not help us. Remember how they lied and manipulated under Clinton? Well, is there any other words that ever come out of their mouths? Well, NAFTA, the World Trade Organization. Look at how corrupt those organizations are. Look at how corrupt those treaties were. Look at how many millions of Americans suffer because of NAFTA. Look at how many people in Mexico suffer because of NAFTA. Look at the environmental degradation. Trans-Pacific Partnership is NAFTA on massive steroids. We will never have our country back in our lifetimes if we allow this to pass. And yet, the media, they're complicit, and that would be expected. But even some on the left have been complicit. The corporate Democrats, the corporate liberals on MSNBC, even on some of the stations where you're listening to this now, but not on Progressive Radio Network, that I can assure you. We still have more to come. We're going to take a look at gold, the Federal Reserve, how you've been lied to and manipulated. We're going to take a look at all these bailouts and what's behind them. And why should the people constantly be made to suffer when the corporations are never made to suffer? They always get out of it and come out stronger. We don't. They're not helping us stop on our home foreclosures. Also, before we go to that, just one other thing, because we always like to give you some insights from the progressive or truth part of an issue. This is from Washington Blog, Global Research. Quote, America and Israel created a monster computer virus threatening nuclear reactors worldwide. It's short, but it's relevant. Even threatens the International Space Station. In their obsession to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons, the United States and Israel created a computer virus called Stuxnet, S-T-U-X-N-E-T, to cut out Iran's nuclear reactors. The virus appears to have spread to other countries. One of the world's top computer security experts, Eugene Kaspersky, said this week that the virus had attacked a Russian nuclear reactor. As the Register notes, quote, the infamous Stuxnet malware, thought to have been developed by the U.S. and Israel to disrupt Iran's nuclear facilities, also managed to cause chaos at a Russian nuclear plant. The revelation came during a session at the Australia's National Press Club last week, in which he argued that those spooks responsible for, quote, offensive technologies don't realize the unintended consequences of releasing malware into the wild. Quote, everything you do is boomerang. It will come back to you. Unfortunately, it's very possible that other nations, which are not in a conflict, will be victims of cyber attacks on critical infrastructure. It's cyberspace. There are no boundaries. And many facilities share the same systems, end quote. Not finished there, Kaspersky also claimed to have heard from Russian space scientists that that even machines on the International Space Station have been infected, quote, from time to time after scientists arrive aboard with infected USBs. And other security experts agree, as British security website V3, in an article entitled Stuxnet, UK and US Nuclear Plants at Risk as Malware Spreads Outside of Russia, reports, they said, and also FireEye and F-Secure told V3, the nature of the software means that it's likely many power plants have fallen victim to the malware. And then it goes on to talk about why this serious. Well, what does this mean? It means that once you get into cyberspace and once you create some virus, you can't control it. So what if it gets into one of our nuclear facilities and causes it to shut down, causes it to go offline, causes it to have problems? The consequences are substantial, and yet no one's touching this. They should. It's important. One thing we're going to touch now is the food we eat. I try to advocate a healthy and reasonable diet, a living food diet, a clean diet, eaten based upon what your body actually needs, not based upon your appetite. And as such, I believe that we should have diet, at least for the average person, that is used incrementally, meaning not everyone can make all the changes all at once. For those who can, great. But the average person, from my experience, can't. They are too accustomed to taste and feel and satiety. And to give them radical changes just won't work. So I say, all right, make one good change per week, but don't go back on it. So that means at the end of the year, you've actually made 100 changes plus, because you've taken one bad thing out of your diet. Let's say it's sugar or artificial sweeteners or coffee or colas or a meat and pork of all types, and then fish and flour products. And in time, you've cleaned up your diet. But you have to substitute something that's healthy in its place. And a lot of people use fish who are getting off meat, especially the heavy meat eaters, and they want that. They still have this false belief that you must have an animal protein to get your muscle-building protein. It's not true. I could show you the longest-lived, strongest animals in the world, the elephant and hippopotamus, rhinoceros. These are long-lived creatures and strong as can be. Mr. Universe, Mr. World, Mr. USA, all vegetarians. So it's about what you eat, how you eat it. But a lot of people are now going in and getting fish, thinking that they're getting something healthy. It's got the omega-3 fatty acids. Yes and no. Now with the pollution of the Pacific, then your salmon, wild salmon, is going to be polluted. Now the Atlantic is also polluted, but not as much, because it doesn't have the radioactivity. So then what to eat? Well, people then start eating tilapia and catfish. If you're from the South, people love catfish. Well, almost all this is factory farmed. This is from David Simon. Quote, as wild fisheries are depleted around the world, fish farming is said to be the silver bullet that will feed the world. Can the industry deliver on its promise? If you eat seaweed, unless you catch it yourself or ask the right questions, the odds are pretty good it comes from a fish farm. The aquaculture industry is like a whale on steroids, growing faster than any other animal agricultural segment and now accounting for half the fish eaten in the United States. And as commercial fishing operations continue to strip the world's oceans of life, with one-third of fishing stocks collapsed already, the rest is going to collapse as well. So here are the 9 reasons you should be concerned about buying fish that is farm-raised. Number 1, farm fish have dubious nutritional value. Why? Because you're not getting the omega-3 fatty acids as you do in wild fish. Why? Because wild fish eat aquatic plants, sea vegetables. Farm fish, however, are fed genetically engineered corn sorghum and feedstuff that contain little or no omega-3s. This unnatural high corn diet also means some farm fish accumulate unhealthy levels of the wrong fatty acids. Further, farm fish are routinely doused with antibiotics, which can cause antibiotic resistance disease in humans, too. Fish farming robs Peter to pay Paul. What do I mean by that? What I mean is they eat more than corn or soy. For example, tuna and salmon that are farm-raised, they eat lots of fish. In fact, for every pound of their own weight, they'll consume 5 pounds of fish. And where do you get that fish? Well, you go out and you fish herring, anchovies, sardines, everything you can catch. That means that you're destroying the world's oceans of all the smaller fish that normally whales and porpoises and will eat, and hence they're starving. Seals, sea lions, tuna, bass, salmon, albatross, penguins, they all eat the small stuff. And now the small stuff is being caught and given to these farm-raised. Fish experience pain and stress. Contrary to the wishful thinking of many a catch-and-release angler, the latest research show conclusively that fish experience pain and stress. In one study, fish injected with bee venom engaged in rocking behavior, a link to pain, and compared to control groups reduced their swimming activity, waiting 3 times longer to eat, and had higher breathing rates. Farm fish are subject to the routine stresses because of hyper-confinement. And just imagine if you put 500 prisoners in one cell. That's what it'd be like to be farm-raised. Farm fish are loaded with disease, and this spreads to wild fish populations. That's right. In fact, farm fish are packed with as tightly as coins in a purse with 27 adult trout, for example, typically in a bathtub-sized space, in a bathtub. These unnatural conditions give rise to disease and parasites, which often migrate off the farm and infect wild fish populations. On Canada's Pacific coast, for example, sea lice infestations are responsible for massive kill-offs of pink salmon that have destroyed 8% of the fish in some local populations. But the damage doesn't end there, because eagles, bears, orcas, and other predators depend on salmon for their existence. Drops in wild salmon numbers cause these species to decline as well. Also, you can't have diseases and parasites infecting your economic units, so operators fight back by dumping enormous quantities of antibiotics and other chemicals into the water, and such toxins damage local ecosystems in ways we're just beginning to understand. One study found that a drug used to combat sea lice kills a variety of non-target marine invertebrates, and travels up to a half a mile and persists in the water for hours. Farm fish are living in their own feces. Well, that's not so unusual. Congress and the White House does the same thing. That's right. Farm fish waste falls as sediment to the seabed in sufficient quantities to overwhelm and kill marine life in the immediate vicinity and for some distance beyond. It also promotes algae growth, which reduces the water's oxygen content and makes it hard to support life. When the Israeli government learned that the algae growth driven by two fish farms in the Red Sea was hurting nearby coastal reefs, it shut them down. In the North Atlantic region alone, up to 2 million runaway salmon escape into the wild each year. The result is at least 20% of the supposed wild salmon caught in the North Atlantic are farmed origin. Escaped fish breed with wild fish and compromise the gene pool, harming the wild population. In fact, embryonic hybrid salmon, for example, are far less viable than their wild counterparts. And then finally, one study found that the aquaculture in Sweden's coastal waters, quote, is not only ecologically, but also economically unsustainable. Another report concludes that fish farming in a Chinese lake is, quote, an economic irrational choice from the perspective of the whole society with an unequal trade-off between environmental costs and economic benefits. Simply put, aquaculture drives heavily upon the environment and costs society. But it's making money. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Just two quick program announcements before we continue, and you're going to find out some really new information upon why the price of gold has been kept down and silver's been kept down, who's behind it, how they did this. It's a major scheme and needs to be exposed, and we're going to do that with my guest Kelly Mitchell, a Canadian strategic business analyst with a lengthy career in investment banking, and he's an expert in trends within the globalized market. And his insights have been praised by economists such as Professor Paul Craig Roberts for the unique and nonconformist approach to peering more deeply into the forces orchestrating the world economy. In effect, he's the person that pulls back the paradigm shield to show us the true players. He's also the author of Gold Wars. And his website is gold-wars.com. We'll go to him in a moment. This Sunday, a premiere of my newest documentary, The Silent Epidemic. And that will be at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, Long Island at noon. And I'll be there, and I'll do a lecture afterwards. I'll be giving two free copies of the film as a part of our outreach social activism support system, to share these with people that you feel it would benefit. If you want to join me for this, please do by calling 631-423-7610. 631-423-7610. And I go out with each of my documentaries to the Cinema Arts Center because the woman who owns that, she promotes social causes. The films she selects are not your Cinemex type of films. She's a very conscientious person, and that's why I donate the film. I go out there on my own time, to support her and the local community, because it's a very viable environmental and health and freedom of choice community out in Long Island. So that's this Sunday. This Friday, I'm going to be doing my only lecture for the next year in the Newark area. It'll be filmed. And it's at 7 o'clock. It's limited. Will be filled as of today. And the lecture is called How Not to Screw Up Your Next Relationship. Because I believe that we have made a mess of the way that we go after relationships, what we do once we're in relationships, and then how do you get out of a bad one, and how do you get into a good one. That'll be Friday night, 7 p.m. And then Saturday at 3 p.m., a different lecture. And that is on death is an absolute, but dying is a choice. How to live a longer life. 3 o'clock. If you want to come to either of these two lectures, and again, this will be the last mention because we're going to be filled, call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. Let's go over to my guest, Kelly Mitchell. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Gary. How are you doing?
Doing great. Kelly, many people believe that the value of gold or silver is based upon what the market dictates, and therefore if the market is telling people, well, gold isn't really not that valuable at this point, and it's reached its peak and is falling down from its high of around 1900 into the 1300 range, and it'll probably go down further. They're assuming that this is based upon some wisdom coming from the marketplace. And yet, there are countries like China and Russia that are shaping the global economy for the future with respect to aggressive gold purchases and mining. And we're not even looking in the United States, will that impact us? We're not even accepting that the dollar will no longer be the reserve currency in the future. We accept it's been there. It's always going to be there. Therefore, the dollar's safe, and everyone wants to come into our bond market. Everyone's coming into our dollars. Everyone's coming into Wall Street. So we're the best in the world at all this. And I'm saying, hold on, before you go there and keep looking at our exceptionalism, why don't you take an honest look at the weaknesses associated with the petrodollar standard, and why it's important, and how does gold impact the petrodollar, and how does gold fit into the massive wealth grabs by governments and the banking cartel we're witnessing today, if people even paid attention. So go through the entire story about gold being manipulated, silver being manipulated, who's behind it, how they're doing it, how they're getting away with it, and what should we do about it.
Yeah, that's you want me to go through the whole thing?
As much as you feel you can.
Okay. Yeah, it's a tall order. I mean, I had to actually cut the book back by about 50 or 60 pages because the publisher said it was too long. You know, the industry just has certain length requirements. So there's a lot of material, and it's a very complicated situation. Now, that being said, probably the most simple way to look at it is they want to suppress the gold price, they being mainly the Western banking cartel, Federal Reserve, and J.P. Morgan, the big banks, and so forth. And actually, there's some foreign banks, Deutsche Bank, any of the major mega banks that kind of sprawl over national into international boundaries, they're all involved in this in some way. And the reason they want to is because the currencies are fiat currencies, they're paperbacked currencies, and they can issue as much as they want. Right? Okay, so that's great, except people start to lose faith in the currencies, and then they look to something like gold and silver as a timeless way to just preserve their wealth. You know, when people have some money and savings, they see that everything's getting more expensive, so they should get gold and silver, because they've always been real money. And in 1971, they cut the gold standard pretty much completely from all currencies in the world. So gold's the canary in the coal mine. Right, when it starts to rise, people, real investors, sophisticated investors, they know something's a little wrong in the markets. And when it rises very quickly, they know something's very seriously wrong. So there's a lot of incentive to suppress the gold price and to keep it down. Now, I don't want to go into the mechanics of how that's done. That gets really complicated and involves the futures market, and that's all in the book. There's a big section on that. But the main mechanism for suppressing the gold price is just to beat up the laws of supply and demand by creating artificial supply. You just create a lot of paper gold. It's not really real. And on the futures market, there's many, many times the amount of gold being sold in the futures market and in other places, in the GLD ETFs and multiple vehicles that vastly inflates the supply of gold, and that keeps the price suppressed because people think they're buying gold, and that money they're trying to buy gold with, they're just buying paper. They're just buying fake paper. You asked about the petrodollar standard, so I want to touch on that. When they cut the gold away from the currency in 1971, they created what's called the petrodollar standard. It was in 1975. It took a few years for them to do it. And the dollar was pretty shaky. The 70s were rough, if people around that time remember. Inflation was bad, and everybody was really scared about the economy. So around 1975, they got the petrodollar, mainly Kissinger. They got the dollar linked to oil. And now if you want to buy oil, any country wants to buy oil, it can only be bought in U.S. dollars. That's changing, by the way. And that has supported the dollar for many years because, think about it, every nation that has excess oil takes dollars. Every nation that needs oil needs dollars. They have to sell cheap goods, like China, in order to get those dollars, in order to buy the oil, in order to keep this cycle going. So it creates a perpetual market, and that's why the dollar is the world's reserve currency. Before that time, it was because the U.S. had a lot of gold. Okay, is this making sense so far?
Yes.
Okay. Now they've abused the petrodollar power. They've just created so many wars of aggression, so many, huge bailouts for the banks, and the corruption's just gotten completely out of hand. And they've recycled so much debt in. Oh, that's another part of the petrodollar standard is these oil-producing countries, the OPEC countries, they reinvest in U.S. treasuries. So it allows the U.S. to create a bigger and bigger debt, right? So it creates this really virtuous circle, not virtuous in the classic sense, but it's helpful for these powers. You know, it's created a long-term steady rise in power that's made the U.S., such a powerful nation. Now, a lot of those countries are starting to question it. Saddam Hussein actually was ready to sell oil for euros, and didn't go too well for him, obviously. Gaddafi tried to create a gold-backed dinar, a regional currency, and was going to accept that for oil. And, well, what happened to him, right? So you can see the footprints of this thing all over the place, and how they're trying to protect this petrodollar standard, and how that's connected to keeping the price of gold suppressed in order to maintain the primacy of the U.S. dollar. A lot of people think that these invasions into these countries are just about grabbing the oil supply. I think there's many factors to it, but one of the primary ones is to say, look, if you want to stop the U.S. currency being the reserve currency of the world, you're going to die. It's sort of that simple. So it's this very serious threat of invasion. They're willing to support the currency with military force, because the currency is this power. You know, if everybody wants your currency, then you can buy anything you want, and you just print it for free. So, does that make sense so far?
Yes.
Okay. Now, let's see. I'm there's so much.
Let me ask you some short answer questions. All right.
Yeah.
Do you see the Federal Reserve having a major part to play in manipulating or controlling the price of gold and silver?
Not directly, but yeah, they're basically saying, they give the wink and then someone else does it.
Okay.
There's a group called the Exchange Stabilization Fund, and this was considered some conspiracy theory for a long time. I don't know why it was passed as a law in the 1930s, created by FDR, and he made gold illegal, right? And at that time, the profits from getting all that gold coming to the Treasury were used to create the ESF, the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And this is a very secretive organization, and it's somewhat part of the Federal Reserve, but there's no clear answers there. Getting information out of the Fed is impossible. You know, they tell you what they want you to hear and nothing else. So the ESF is definitely manipulating a lot of things. Exactly what they do and how they do it is hard to say, because they don't have to put a yearly report. They don't have to say what they're doing.
Okay. Is it true that we have a great deal of people who are holding paper gold certificates and that have no actual physical gold in that bank?
In which bank?
In any bank.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The gold ETF, GLD, it's an exchange-traded fund.
Mm-hmm.
And how much gold is there? I mean, there's some gold there, yeah, but the banks are doing something very funny with that fund. They're using it as a sort of a central bank to supply gold. A lot of people are putting claims on their gold, and the banks are giving them the stiff arm, and they're having a harder and harder time doing it. But if you can look at things like J.P. Morgan's vaults going down by 80% overnight one night. Like 80% of J.P. Morgan's gold disappeared in 24 hours. And if people can't realize that that's actually something really, really weird going on there. You see what I'm saying?
Well, let's make it more simple. How about when Germany asked for the return of its gold, and the United States couldn't do it all at once, had to do it over a number of years?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know why Germany's putting up with it. My guess is they're saying, well, we're going to get what we can. But we know we're not going to get it all. But if we get, you know, if we can get like 20 or 30% of it, then we'll be pretty happy with that. That's my guess.
All right, two short answers because we're running out of time. Do you believe or do you foresee when the dollar will no longer be the reserve currency and there'll be other currencies, mixed currencies, the yuan and others, to take its place?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's no question. The dollar has been in long-term decline for 12, 14 years. It was 140 points when Bush took office. Now it's at 70. I mean, it's a 50% reduction value.
Do you believe that this could happen in the next 3 or 4 years?
Possibly. I don't think it's going to be a sudden event. It's because it's led by China and with Russia as a real elbow man there. And China is careful and slow.
Okay.
They're going to very slowly supplant the dollar, just one step at a time. And they don't really want to upset the global markets. It's not in their interest to do so.
That's correct. They wouldn't have any place to sell their cheap products.
Right. And other things.
Yes. So, yeah. Lastly, do you see the real value of gold coming up in the foreseeable future to what it should be?
There's no telling what it should be. It's been suppressed so long. But, yeah, I see it coming up. I mean, it shot up to 1900, right? And then
yes,
it fell back down. And I think it'll go to 3, 4, 5,000 in the next 4 or 5 years. But they're able to hold this game pretty strong, longer than most people thought possible. So it's difficult to say when it'll fail.
Right.
One of the things I'll tell you is don't let people tell you when stuff's going to happen, because nobody knows.
I agree. Kelly Mitchell, thank you for giving us this insight. It'll happen a lot quicker if we get the truth out, and you have certainly done a great deal of good. The book is called Gold Wars, The Battle for the Global Economy. Website is gold-wars.com. Kelly Mitchell, my guest. Thank you, Kelly.
Okay, thanks, Gary.
And we're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Now let's say hello to Lou Ann Panessi. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hello, Gary. Very powerful, powerful information, and thank you for that guest. I have an interesting situation, and maybe you can bring this up in your lecture on relationships. This is very, very common, and this comes to me in my emails as well. I worked with a gentleman yesterday, very much overweight and suffers with arthritis. He is interested in getting on a whole protocol, so we gave him a protocol. He went home. 4 months later, he comes back, heavier than ever, still with arthritis, and his daughter comes with him, who's grossly overweight, and she's very angry about the diet that he's on, which is an organic vegan diet, which we ease him into. This is a man that eats bacon every day, and he has, deli meat, and he used to drink 10 cups of coffee a day, and now he's down to 3. And basically, the daughter says to me, how can anyone be on this kind of a diet? Well, the bigger question is, how can people who have family members who are not supporting them actually get onto this kind of a plan? And this guy, the gentleman is older. He's in his early 80s.
Okay, let me take a crack at it.
Go ahead.
First, you have to ask, are the choices that a person's making, whether they're emotional choices or physical choices, financial choices, career choices, or health choices, are these sustainable with a good outcome? And for that, you have to really go down to the individual pieces. You can't look at this as some broad waving scheme. You have to say, if I eat this bacon, if I have these eggs, if I eat this sugar and this cereal, and if I drink this coffee, can that sustain health or does it undermine it? And you have to take every single action in your life and ask the same question. And unfortunately, that is not what people do. They validate their choices based upon the comfort they feel by how other people act towards them for the choices they've made. More often than not, when you have overweight people, you'll have a whole family overweight, or you have people who develop a support system that justifies their being overweight. Well, this person's stressed. Well, it's hormones, or it's their thyroid. No, it's not. But that's what they want to do. So you have to differentiate the real self of the person and the people in their environment versus the conditioned ego. And remember, all egos manipulate through drama. Anytime someone's needing to show drama, they're showing you their ego. They're showing you their insecurity. Hence, they're showing you they're not conscious of the true value of healthier choices. So that means that person should not have a person working with them who themselves are not an example of how to lead in a positive way. So if a person's trying to break through old habits, but they're surrounded by people who are addicted to the same bad habits, there's no way that they're going to get out of that hole. As one person digs dirt and throws it over their shoulder, the other person digs the same dirt and throws it right back over the other shoulder. So both people end up working hard and getting further into this hole. That's how I would answer it.
Yep.
All,
good.
All the best to you.
Thank you.
Eutrice Leeds standing by. Hi, Eutrice.
Hello, Gary. And today we're talking about, as it happens, it just happened this morning. I was prescient in that the issue of immigration reform is stalled. But we'll be talking with a professor to discuss the state of play with the pro-immigration lobby and the Obama administration now that immigration talks are stalled, and we'll also be talking about President Clinton's smackdown of Obama over Obamacare.
Was that Clinton smacking down, or was that the Clinton campaign smacking down?
It's one of the same.
Yes.
I had titled it "How Hill Was Flacking for How Bill Flacked for Hill," on smacking Obama down.
For the very things that they themselves advocated, but now they're seeing the political winds change, and they want to capitalize on that and bring up the sales for their campaign. It's so obvious.
It's ridiculous, but that's where we're going today.
Well, the entire "let's make Hillary the first woman president" is ridiculous, and unfortunately the corporate Democrats and corporate liberals seem to think of nothing else. So I look forward to hearing what you have to say. As always, Eutrice Leeds, the dynamic program, coming at you right now.